Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Pop Almanac, episode 8.
Presented by Culture Map Austin, I am Brendan K. O'Grady.
I'm Duncan Carson. Brendan, how are you doing today?
I'm feeling good. I'm raring to go.
You're feeling ready to make some choices between some arbitrary things?
Hard choices that have to be made, Duncan.
Here's our topic, everybody, and I was thinking about candy bars is why it happened. Because when bear with me. When I was growing up, I really
thinking about candy bars, eh? Before I bear with you, how much time do you spend in an average day idly thinking about candy bars?
I don't know. How much time do we spend breathing? How do you gauge these things?
It's in that sub part of your brain that like regulates just even non-conscious. Biology. I understand.
But sometimes you think about it. Like Halloween just happened. Whatever. I'm not going to get into the specifics. But as a kid, I was a big fan of Milky Ways. You know, the Milky Way caramel chocolate is perfect. And I didn't like Snickers because the inclusion of peanuts just for some reason didn't sit right with me. And so as a kid, I would go to the mini mart up the street and buy a Milky Way. And in my mind, I was just like, suck that, Snickers. Yeah, because I assumed that they were in direct competition with one another. And that by supporting Milky Way, I was making a statement and defining myself as an individual. It turns out they're both made by the same company, you guys.
Yeah.
Right? M&M Mars, they make everything. That was a real shocker.
Is the Milky Way... It's so weird to me. The Milky Way is basically a Snickers without peanuts? Is that basically the same thing?
I feel like there might be some sort of nougat consistency difference.
Most candy bars are basically the same thing as every other candy bar. Just different volumes of things.
We can always consult the nougat core differential index.
Yeah, there's...
And, I mean, find out what the hard differences are.
But it's that conception of this being versus that, even though nobody needs to care. Nobody cares. There's no competition between candy bars. Right? It's that, and I want to talk about that in terms of pop culture.
Right. And this is a topic that you and I have talked about a little bit, kind of. We briefly touched on one of the things we'll talk about later on a previous episode. But it's the idea of what we've termed as these false dichotomies. The way we define these things is that we notice that in culture, we seem to gravitate toward pairing things off and then choosing sides against them, even when there's no conceivable natural way to do it. Like the classic example that you might hear is like when someone asks you chocolate or vanilla. Chocolate or vanilla, as though those are opposite things.
Chocolate or vanilla, Sam?
I used to say vanilla, but now I finally like chocolate, so it's a tie.
Wow.
Okay, but here's the thing. You just said, I used to say, in that this has come up before.
No, well, I used to really hate chocolate, and people would always give me a hard time about it.
So you had an aggressive pro-vanilla stance, and it put people off. We understand.
We all had to choose. I didn't like chocolate soft serve ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
So in that context, vanilla all the way. In the twist, that's an abomination.
But that's not arbitrary. That's having a preference for one or the other. It's not like someone asking you to choose, but you love both of them.
But the arbitrary thing is that it was always chocolate and vanilla and not vanilla or mint chip. It was never bubblegum ice cream versus chocolate ice cream.
Exactly. Well, one has to assume that when ice cream was invented, the flavor choices were minimal.
Right. There was brown and white. And then over time, we came to call them chocolate and vanilla.
But we're obsessed with making choices.
Right. So the criteria for what we're talking about today are twofold in these false dichotomies. One is that we find things that are dyads. They're paired together in the cultural lexicon for whatever reasons. That might be because of the time and place surrounding them, the context in which they came to everyone's awareness, or their subject matter, or any other kind of similarity that people kind of pick up on between the two.
Right. And you have one that you like to make people choose in conversation. Between a couple of popular movie franchises, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll get to that in one second. I want to say the other criterion.
Oh, of course.
The other criterion is we have to point out there has to be a perceived opposition between these two things.
Right.
And that's really at the heart of what makes this a false dichotomy, because not only do people pair them together, but then they act as though those things are in competition with each other, or that you have to have one or the other in some way.
So just the onus here is to find a perceived similarity and a perceived opposition.
Right. Okay.
Because chocolate and vanilla ice cream are similar things.
There is a similarity to those two things, if nothing else, in them both being ice creams.
Right.
Which specific flavors would people wound up pairing off? Sure, those are both really popular. I don't know if they're the two most popular flavors ever.
Exactly.
In fact, I would venture to say that maybe the most popular flavor of ice cream over... This is just a guess and my kind of approximation. Most popular flavor of ice cream ever, probably combine the two, I'm guessing chocolate chip ice cream.
Exactly. So,
right?
basically what we're doing here today is recreating that scene in the election with apples and bananas. Why not an orange? All right? That's...
Or, to put it in more common parlance, we're recreating that Republican debate in which we explain state taxes versus federal taxes are apples and oranges. Different things, you guys. Herman
so
Cain,
different.
999.
That's way more of a common explanation for that.
Ron Paul and the Fed.
We did an all-own election by Alexander Payne on VHS.
It's an okay movie.
All right.
Okay, to get back to the example that you were alluding to, I long since paired a couple of these movies together. I chose a pair of movies that I once posed as my big conversation starter at a big annual holiday party that my friends would have, and I started a near riot. Literally, people wound up finding themselves so invested in this conversation that they almost fought each other. I present to you... Two films that spawn film franchises, both from a similar era in the 80s, both use a not very common specific narrative plot device, that being time travel, right? But they were not just little genre movies. They were like well large budgeted, mass marketed, wide audience seeking movies. And these two movies both have very strong things to say philosophically. They've both been studied academically in great extent. One, it's true. They both, you really can.
I'm sure they have.
These two films. I said you have to pick one or the other, and if you pick one, the other one never exists, and you'll never have seen it. Nothing associated with ever exists.
So you added an extra wrinkle to this,
right? Well, because I created stakes for people, right?
Right.
I created a dichotomy, and I gave them a perceived opposition that had actual weight behind it, right? Because like most things, people like both.
Okay, what are the two movies?
Back to the Future versus Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Okay, so we have to choose one, and then the other one is gone.
Right, so the Back to the Future trilogy of films.
So you're like, an arbitrary choice is not enough. We're going to make this like a Sophie's choice.
Exactly.
And the other one gets shot.
Right, because everyone I know likes both of those movies a lot. And anyone who's seen the sequels knows that Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey is fucking great. And that Back to the Future 2 is fine, and Back to the Future 3 is quite a lot of fun. Everyone knows that there's a lot at stake just in the fact that we like them. But I really wanted to drive home, right, that not only is this a false dichotomy, but I'm gonna make you really care about it because you have to really prefer one. I'm making you get really deep down, right? Make that Sophie's choice.
I'm ready to riot right now. Yeah, it's Back to the Future all the way. Right, guys?
Ooh.
Ooh. Look at that. Why
Sam,
not?
Sam Podboss Pitchell, everybody, instantly narrowed her eyes and reacted the way that many people do. Now before I let you guys go at it, I will point out that uniformly in the party where this was posed in, it was split along lines of how much pot you smoke.
Well, then that makes sense. But when you said it, the second that you said it, Bill and Ted.
Really?
Yeah.
Gut reaction. Excellent Adventure all the way, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Back to the Future. Sorry.
I am so proud of myself right now, you
guys.
Wow.
I'm just, like, they don't actually care about time travel in Bill and Ted. They just...
I don't know if it's in my defense, but given the point that Brendan just made, I think this makes a little sense. But, I don't know, I have a soft spot for stoner comedies. What do you want?
Well, yeah, and the thing is, it is a stoner classic. Like, I mean, Bill and Ted's is a stoner classic, but also the way that it deals with the subject matter is actually, like, kind of loose and ponderous, especially when you get into, like, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, right, which is a sequel that in some ways eclipses the original. And it's all about like religion and faith and philosophy and shit. Like they go on this metaphysical tour of the afterlife and different conceptions of the afterlife and how different philosophies view mortality.
Yeah.
And you know the great questions of eternity, right? And that's the kind of thing that lends itself to sitting around super late at night.
That must be a great term paper. All right, but
Back to the Future addresses as many pressing questions. I think another more superficial part of it is I really don't like Michael J. Fox.
Ooh, wow, that's a whole nother discussion.
Wow. Now, regardless of which side you fall, who comes down against America's sweetheart, Michael J. Fox?
What are you, for Parkinson's disease? Come on. But no, I like Back to the Future because it actually explores questions like that, but about time travel, like... Not that I'm agreeing with the slowly disappearing in the photograph or anything, but...
Right, you just love time travel.
I do, I love it, and it
I
takes
do too.
It more seriously, well, and...
But it doesn't necessarily take it more seriously. Like,
Back to the Future 2 is my favorite, by the way.
I love the idea of talking about taking something totally fake that doesn't exist.
Right,
guys,
right.
We just need to take right. this concept that we've all made up more seriously.
Flux capacitors yeah. and such.
It could exist. All right. All right.
No. But I'm going to point something out. Robert Zemeckis made a straight-ahead adventure movie, right? You know, like fun, straight, like very... There's a lot of narrative thrust that carries the movie from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And it involves time travel. But Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure actually shows... like the device of time travel interacting with itself in a much more interesting and realistic way, right? Part of the plot, part of the plot, literally, it addresses questions of paradox and wait, okay, so I'll just wind my watch, so I'll go back and remind myself to put the keys here, and he reaches down and the keys are there.
Where did, okay.
But see, that's the kind of thing that Back to the Future glosses over.
You said the device was realistic.
Hang
what
on.
Powers the phone booth? All right,
that's the kind of thing. That Back to the Future, right? Like, you're mm-hmm. saying, oh, because there's a made-up device, the flux capacitor
yeah.
that Dr. Emmett Brown created
sure.
to make a DeLorean
yep.
get customized to run on plutonium.
Very solid.
Right.
Completely logical to me.
Yeah, so because that's there, you're okay with the idea that Michael J. Fox is slowly disappearing as the result of his time travel.
I'm willing to accept that.
I think that what you want...
Logically,
you want is just a narrative frame that makes more sense to you, whereas mm-hmm. Bill and Ted is more interested in the idea of what time travel is.
No,
but how is
it's
that
not
a narrative frame? They've got... It's got a lot going on. There's the sci-fi element with the time travel. There's the stoner comedy, obviously. There's... they like 80s teen high school mm-hmm. thing
yeah.
where they, you know, they,
yeah.
there's like a lot of genres that it's mixing.
It's also hilarious. Like, it's a really great comedy in and of itself. It's
you know what?
Funny.
It's a great movie. I don't want it to not exist. That badly.
Well.
But I've been forced to make this choice, and now we can't move on with the podcast until this is settled. All right? So, no. But that's what we're getting at, right? Like, that's why that's such a great conversation starter.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the epitome of a false dichotomy. Like, I paired these things together based on perceived similarity, right? I listed off similarities between them, right?
Yeah.
And I gave you emotional stakes to the opposition, to me putting them against each other.
Yeah.
And I started this argument.
Right.
For the record, I have never... ever stated which one I would choose.
Never taken a side.
Whenever someone asks me, I say I pose the question to you.
Okay. Calm down, Charlie Rose.
Would you like me to go on record?
Yeah, I'd like you to go on record.
Officially?
Yeah.
For a long time, I thought it was Back to the Future.
That's good.
Because I love Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And it is one of those era-defining big movies that more and more I feel like people of our age, our general generation, is calling that movie their favorite movie of all time.
Yeah.
And then I realized I've seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure 5 times as many times as Back to the Future. I've seen them both a lot.
Sure.
It's Bill and Ted.
Bill and Ted. Well, I don't know. I'd watch them back to back. It's not like a thing. But if I have to choose, I'm ready to fight about it.
There are 5 movies. I think you mean back to back to back to back to back to back in advance of the next Bill and Ted movie, which is supposedly going to happen.
I might fall asleep before getting to Back to the Future 3.
Wait. Bill and Ted movies...
Starring Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves. They're
yeah.
both on board.
Yeah.
Alex Winter has reportedly been working on the script for it.
Well, what else
is he doing? Hey, he's got a nice little career.
Like, you think that perm maintains itself? All right, he's got.
I will have no
do.
More Alex Winter bashing. He's a successful television producer and director. He went to a different place in his career.
So that's a fun one, and it's like a thing. It's
we can't all star in the remake of When the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, can't we?
We can wish we did.
We can. We can all just hang out with John Hamm on that one. Anyway.
Hamio.
But that one's like a personal thing because those are so old and like superficially similar. What I always get caught up in like following movies is when movies will come up back to back that are very similar in subject matter.
Right.
And everybody just instantly assumes that, they're going head to head.
Right.
Because it happens a lot.
And they assume that one is better than the other before they even go into it. Or they see one and they prefer it. So now they
like
one's better.
Like they're coming up, there's going to be 2 Snow White movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like Snow White and the Huntsman and like Mirror Mirror. And I feel like I want to choose one even before months before they come out.
Right.
But my favorite example of this is the Christopher Nolan's The Prestige, which came out a little bit after Neil Berger's The Illusionist.
The Illusionist.
Which, and they're both movies about magicians, so, and they came out the same year, so everybody's like, oh man, they feel the need to compare them. And so do I, because The Prestige is so much better, you guys.
Yeah, I have no drive to compare the two. I like The Prestige fine as a film, and The Illusionist just didn't look very good. Even though I like Edward Norton, it just didn't look very good, and I didn't see it.
Oh, it's such a B-movie, but like, I'll find people on the IMDb board for The Prestige, they're just like, The Illusionist is better. I'm like, who cares? Why are you here? What are you doing? And it's just, you know, completely different movies on the face of it, because the Illusionist is just like sort of a decent period drama with a big plot twist like The Usual Suspects that I totally saw coming because I'm smart.
Right.
And The Prestige is a lot more to unpack because it's, you know, Nolan and it's layered. And
well, and it has plot twists, but they are very left field.
Yeah, they're pretty left field.
I mean, one of the plot twists, and not spoiling anything at all because you should see the movie, it's good, one of the plot twists is the kind of thing where if that was the only plot twist, you would have just guessed it and figured it out. And then the other one, right. And then the other one is apparently Nikola Tesla is magic.
There's a lot of dissension about that. All right, don't get me started.
FYI, for the entirety of this conversation so far, I was getting one of those movies confused with The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Oh my god!
It doesn't even matter which one.
Wow.
But what? Now we're all on the same page.
That has nothing to do with any other movie.
Hang on, I'm gonna tie it all back. Imaginarium and Dr. Parnassus, final film featuring Heath Ledger. Heath Ledger famously played, won an Oscar for playing the Joker in another movie, The Dark Knight, directed by Christopher Nolan, who we were talking about.
Yes.
Tangent.
Nailed it.
Tangent.
Nailed it. But, yeah.
No, I have a tangent for you.
What's that?
What's your favorite Christopher Nolan movie?
Oh, God, don't put me on this spot.
Is it The Prestige? Because you seem to really like it. You know what? Just chatting about this beforehand, you seem
know
to
what?
Really like it.
It's The Prestige.
That's your favorite Christopher Nolan
movie? I would watch that twice in a row. Like, I love a bunch of his movies. Like, we were debating it, like Memento, The Dark Knight.
Right.
Inception is probably up there, but The Prestige all the way. Yeah.
More than Memento.
I really like Memento, but Memento's such a downer. So is Prestige.
Memento is one of a handful of movies ever that I saw in the theater, liked it so much that I told my friend about it, and we went back to watch it, like, the next day.
Sure, yeah.
So I saw it multiple times in the theater. Watching it again recently, it doesn't quite hold up to the standard that I had created for it in my brain as how good it was. It's still very, very good, but I think Chris Nolan has made tremendous movies.
It's pretty great, and it relies really heavily on that sort of like structure,
right?
And not just the backwards
which
thing,
is almost a gimmick.
Not just the backwards thing, but it's gimmicky with that flashback that keeps interrupting it too,
right?
Because it's almost like three regular scenes and then the black and white scene,
right?
And it keeps you going, but it gets real formulaic after a little while.
Yeah,
it's probably my number two Nolan movie.
I still love the creativity behind it, and I love it conceptually so much that it's up there for me as well. But I really think that Christopher Nolan is at this point. The appropriately deserved backlash has gone way too far the other way. The fact is, The Dark Knight is hands down his most rewatchable movie. That
sure.
movie you can rewatch over and over again for all of its flaws,
yeah.
which we've kind of talked about in our very first episode. But my favorite Christopher Nolan movie, and boy, the backlash was very fast. But I mean, it's just wrong because people don't know how to watch a movie anymore.
Sure,
Inception is his best film.
Inception
is his best film.
Like by a hair or by a lot.
Well, I think it's clearly his best film, but the difference between his, you know, Christopher Nolan's best work is you know, I guess kind of marginal.
Yeah. I mean, rewatchability is really important to me, and I fell asleep in the middle of Inception the second time.
I saw Inception twice in the theaters.
Yeah. Well, no, like on DVD, I was like, this exposition in the middle is killing me.
The exposition never bothered me, and I really like the thematic drive that it has. And with people talking about how there's no real characters in it, that's crazy because Marion Cotillard is a great character in that movie. She's defined very strongly by a base emotion, right? One base emotion, which is kind of jealousy. It's her wanting to bring Cobb back into the world that you know that he promised they'd have together.
Yeah, no, it's great.
And I absolutely love the ending. And I just want to talk about it because we're already on the subject. Anybody who walked out of that movie saying, "Oh, so was it all a dream?" is dumb. The point of that final scene is that Cobb has a totem that he spins to ground himself in reality, to prove to himself which reality he's in.
Uh-huh.
The previous scene, he makes a decision choosing one reality over the other, letting his wife go so he can be with his family in what we presume is the real reality. When he spins the top, he walks away from it and the camera lingers on the top as we see him with his back to the top, yeah, hugging his kids. We see the top spinning, and then maybe it falters, maybe it doesn't. The point is, it doesn't matter which reality you're in. We choose the reality that we want.
Well, it doesn't matter to him. I can see why people get hung up on it. I didn't care.
Why?
But the entirety of the previous 2 hours is about defining the one level of reality versus the dreams. And I can see why people would, like, have that rug taken out from under them at the end and get mad.
But the rug isn't taken out. Like, there are different levels, and then you choose which end you come out on, essentially.
Right.
Like, you choose if you want to follow it down into its furthest depths in which you're in one reality, or up into the outer layers. Apart from being a really incredibly well-made movie,
right,
and I enjoy the acting and lots of other things about it, and I think that the dialogue in that movie is much better than in The Dark Knight, even if it is often expository. Like, you like time travel a lot.
Yeah.
I like high concept genre fiction-y stuff to the point that I don't mind a lot of exposition in a high concept movie like this. And mostly I just think the movie comes together so well.
Prestige is better. Sorry.
Fine. We spent entirely too much time talking about Christopher Nolan.
Well, I have a devil's advocate question for you, since this is such like a philosophical discussion.
Yeah, just do it.
To begin with.
Yeah.
What if you were challenging someone to choose between two things that weren't quite so similar? Like, would these like rules or these things that we're talking about apply?
Not really.
You got to give me the example to really know what you're talking about.
Okay, I don't know. I can't. I guess anything could be similar to anything else if you want to like go in enough of a wide circle to, especially when you're talking about pop culture. But like things from different genres or time periods or things that are obviously like separate for concrete reasons that are kind of like impassable.
Well, there's no reason to choose between The Prestige and Memento. Because one's like a gritty contemporary crime thriller, and one's a period piece with fantastical machines. And, like, there's no subject matter, there's no...
Well, part of the first criteria of like, what makes for these false dichotomies is just recognizing that these things just seem to emerge culturally. Like, people latch on to the idea that there's a similarity. And that's part of what defines them as a pair to begin with. And then the fact that they're also seen as being in competition with each other is the second half to it. So, like, why can't we do that? I mean, I guess we, in theory, could, but nobody out there seems to want to talk about Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill versus Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo, right? Even though one is, is a classic, definitive samurai movie.
You can make that debate, yeah.
But people don't gravitate toward doing it.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be a natural dichotomy in the cultural lexicon.
Well, I bet Tarantino nerds would do that. I think what Sam's asking is, like, why don't people compare Inception to Ordinary People? Why don't we do that?
But also, if we're talking about...
that was my impression of you, by the way.
Thank you. That's exactly what I sound like. I'm sure people can't even tell who just stopped talking.
They couldn't see it on the microphone, but you imitated her new bangs perfectly.
Right here, anyway.
I guess the larger question is, if we're saying that there is some thing in our cultural consciousness that pairs things together,
is that thing?
Yeah.
What's that? It's very...
I mean, is it really just as obvious as like, hey, these are both about time travel? What's the deal?
It can be subject matter. It can be time and place of, like, they get released at the same time.
I feel like that one is an organic one that this dude forces on people. It's not like people are going around like, Back to the Future is better. But when you bring it up like that, people feel compelled to make a decision because there's something similar about them.
Do you think it's partly also that people are always looking for a competition generally?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, I think when we...
That's how we engage with...
5 minutes ago when we started this podcast, but I was thinking of, like, the first sort of example I can think of where someone was like, well, what's your favorite? And I was like, well, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
It was New Kids on the Block. Because everyone had a favorite New Kid.
Slow your roll. We'll get there.
We are going to be touching on this later.
I've got strong opinions. So
we knew you would.
Just pay attention.
Excellent.
But that's how we engage with culture. We feel the need to, when we love something, we take so much ownership of it without consciously realizing it, that when it's in conflict with anything, even a completely arbitrary way, we're like, no, what?
Right.
Inception. All right. Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to listen to Joseph Gordon-Levitt lecture me to death about how the dream shit works. No way, dude.
Oh,
Prestige.
Yes,
and And while wait, I'm sorry, this just hit me right now.
What's that?
Here are two 20-something young talented men who are dreamboats who Sam has now expressed on microphone to be into.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt versus James Franco.
Ooh.
Sam Pitchell.
Gun to your head.
Ooh. Gun to your head.
I like this one. Let's see. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, because if we dated, I feel like he'd be a lot more attentive, whereas James Franco is so busy with all his different projects that he'd never really have time for me.
Also, even though you're like 5 foot nothing and 50 pounds, you could probably wear Joseph Gordon-Levitt's clothes.
Probably.
Well,
isn't that a reason?
Couple
sizes
smaller.
That's my number one criteria for guys I date. They have to be exactly.
Also,
I feel like
you could never be sure that James Franco wasn't dating you as part of an art installation.
He actually has a long-term girlfriend who he's been dating for like years and years, which is like the weirdest part of everything. Also, sidebar, we'll include a link to this in our post. But did everyone see the photo of James Franco's ass on the cover of some magazine recently?
No.
Great. I'll put a link in there for you.
I don't have James Franco Google alerts set up.
That's
normal people do not.
Really didn't come up for me.
Well,
I'm
sure our fans want
to
see it.
I had a few other similar movies I wanted to get to. If we could stop talking about asses. No. Dante's Peak versus Volcano. Remember that?
Volcano.
Saving Private Ryan versus The Thin Red Line.
I know what you're going to pick. Duncan has the most gigantic raging boner for Terrence Malick.
He's the best. He was just here. He was here.
He was filming Ryan Gosling at Fun 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 Fest.
We'll put links to that, but here's the thing, you superficial ninnies. Terrence Malick was right next to him the whole time.
Yeah, no one gave a shit about
Come on. That killed me. Like,
wearing a jaunty hat and everything.
Like his awesome Texas hat and just directing. And I feel like he was capturing the hipster, emo, fun people like he would the Native American tribes in A New World. Like, I don't know what this movie's about, that he's filming with Ryan Gosling, but that's what it is.
I don't know what you think emo is, that Slayer would be headlining an emo festival.
Yeah, well, I just mean, like, Austin hipsters.
It's an ironic hipster fest.
Yeah, do you think, like, 70% of that crowd was seeing Slayer, ironically? Let's...
Speaking of ironic hipster fest, Sam, did you have fun at Fun 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 Fest?
Yeah, how'd it go?
I did have a good time. I managed to see most of the bands that I liked, which were bands like No Bunny.
Hot Snakes?
No, I didn't see Hot Snakes.
Murder City Devils?
Really, I didn't get to see much on Sunday, but I did. No Bunny was my big one. I love No Bunny. I'll put a video in because everyone should love him too. The OCs were amazing. So.
The OCs?
Yeah.
Did you see Ty Siegel?
The OCs versus the television show The O.C.
That's not a thing.
Yes, it is!
You see, if you want to inorganically pair these things, you have to put as much legwork as I did into Back to the Future versus Bill and Ted's.
Legwork? You threw a grenade and just let other people explode.
I explained the things they had in common, time, place. I put the effort into it. And... More importantly, I got to set fire to the place and watch it burn while I fiddled. That was the important part of that conversation. And by the way, I will take Saving Private Ryan over Thin Red Line. And I love Thin Red Line. I think it's great. But Saving Private Ryan is probably Spielberg's best movie, in my opinion. Or in a small handful with maybe Jaws and like Munich. But Saving Private Ryan, I feel like, is probably the best war film. Probably the best anyone's filmed war before.
Like, I feel it's a great, like, watching characters in a war film, but Thin Red Line, I get out of that. I feel like I went to war. That's a really douchey thing to say. But it's so...
Yeah, it is.
His style is so experiential and, like, the tone poem of the score and just the poetry of it.
Yeah, very beautiful, but I also... That's another good example of a movie where, as good as it is, I don't feel the need to revisit it very much to keep its place in my mind and heart where it's supposed to be, you know?
Should get the Criterion Blu-ray. It's pretty great.
I just picture... This is why you don't sleep.
I don't sleep
that
much.
You just stay up all night long.
Just watch Terrence Malick movies over and over.
Over and over again.
Tree of Life, let's go. It came out in October. But that's the thing. Like, it has to be like a subject thing or movies released chronologically like that. And those two were up for Best Picture in the same year. So it was very like, oh, these two World War II movies.
And in a lot of ways, they were the favorites. Like, Saving Private Ryan was heavily favored, but a lot of people thought that, you know, Terrence Malick hadn't made a movie in a long time.
Yeah, it was his big comeback.
A lot of people thought that was going to be something that could be the surprise
like
winner.
Everybody wanted to be in that movie. Like, George Clooney and Sean Penn are
and Ted Danson.
Ted Danson. There's a lot of people in Thin Red Line.
And then of course Shakespeare in Love won.
But we were discussing this topic and we realized it doesn't happen with television.
Yeah, we were trying to think of examples of this and Sam, this speaks kind of to you saying, you know, like why can't you just pair other things together? Right. Certain media seem, let's not say immune, but certain media seem to not lend itself to these kinds of making these kinds of associations where they get paired together and perceived as an opposition.
Especially the way we consume television now, because there's no, like, airtime conflicts. I'll just DVR one and watch the other, or watch it on the internet. Or
yeah, I feel like maybe it does come up, but in, like, the opposite way. Like, oh, which one's worse? Like, Whitney or New Girl, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, Whitney.
Whitney, you guys.
Because I guess that goes back to the things being thematic. Because if you have two, unless you do it with like, hey, 90210 now or old 90210, you know, like things have to be close. I could see you doing it with like Gossip Girl and 90210 or things that are like similar. But I hear it. I do hear it. But the question that I always hear isn't like, which one do you like more? It's which one
is worse.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, for people's preferences and how they watch television, as good as TV has gotten, a lot of times I think people still tend to engage with TV the way they used to, or the way they always have, which is, I just want to turn it on and be entertained. People aren't watching The X Factor instead of American Idol, right? They're watching both. People aren't watching people who watch daytime soap operas don't watch General Hospital, or didn't watch General Hospital, because they hated The Bold and the Beautiful.
Maybe there are soap opera fans that argue about soap operas.
Yeah, I will
operas.
Say, last week, actually,
that would make sense to me.
I overheard a fight, an actual argument between three friends over Bad Girls Club versus I Love New York.
I know who these friends are.
Do they watch it for the right reasons?
Yeah, and I cannot possibly think they're
probably very high.
Yeah, well,
are there right reasons to watch Bad Girls Club? Okay, let's not go there.
Hang on, really fast, very small tangent. You mentioned, of course, in case anyone missed it, Duncan just slyly under his breath advocated for The New Girl.
It was right in the mic.
We talked about it last week. We talked about it last... Well, I didn't say it wasn't going to be picked up.
Yeah.
Last week, we just talked about your affection for The New Girl and Zooey Deschanel.
Yep.
While we were podcasting, news broke that Zooey Deschanel and her husband, Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard, are divorcing.
Divorced, yep.
You know what this means? Kismet, I'm finally going to have sex with Ben Gibbard.
I'm happy for you, man.
Finally! Oh, my God.
We both would.
I can't believe
Look
it.
Look at that.
Can't believe it.
That's going to be great. Anyway. So, yeah, but nobody compares, like, rant. You could make arbitrary comparisons among television shows. Like, what was the best multi-camera studio audience sitcom of all time, MASH or Cheers?
Right.
Nobody cares. They're just shows that people like.
Yeah. And of course, I don't remember the time slot differences, but nobody's watching, you know, MASH, the last years of MASH, instead of Cheers, because they prefer it to Cheers and they want it over Cheers.
The only one I ever did
they just hang out with it.
That now just all of a sudden occurred to me.
Right.
Is because they were contemporaries. Was ER versus Chicago Hope. Remember that?
I don't remember Chicago Hope having any competition with ER.
Come on.
ER was a better show.
It had Anna Markin. ER all the way, but I think I read that one.
I do also hear it about shows in competition with themselves. Like, there's the ever-present, you know, which season of SNL, which Weekend Update anchors, whatever.
Yeah.
But there's, like, you know, early years versus later years, certain writers. Versus
and that's part of our larger tendency to rank everything, like our inexplicable Nolan tangent from before.
Right.
Because that's just what pop culture is, but it's not really an opposition.
It's still making someone choose.
There's a lot of that with TV, where people feel the need to be like, oh, it's not as good as last season of Community. I'm like, it's still happening. Let's calm down.
Well, you're mentioning Community right now. Like, where these false dichotomies do happen in television, they happen with a much smaller group of people who are tightly attuned to very specific things.
Oh, yeah.
The majority of people, a much, much larger number of people enjoy The Big Bang Theory than hate it and vocally hate it online.
Yeah.
It's a popular show.
Sigh.
But
picking up my sigh microphone.
But when The Big Bang Theory moved to Thursday nights in the same
Community.
Time zone as Community, people like us who were big fans of Community and also part of that vocal minority who thinks The Big Bang Theory is pure shit, we now have a dichotomy that I don't know how false it is. The fact is, and if you know, NBC was already going to have enough of a hard time bringing viewers into Community without taking a show that's very popular in what Community's best demographics would be and letting them stay head-to-head against one another, right? Like, The Big Bang Theory steps in, and now there's just no chance that Community's ever going to be the big breakout hit of that time slot.
It's never going to happen.
Well, judging by the number of people who are going crazy over Donald Glover this weekend.
At Fun 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 Fest.
At Fun 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 Fest.
Donald Glover, he was here as a comic and a...
Did he perform as Childish Gambino?
Yeah, he did two sets.
He did both. But I just feel like there's, like, but TV is just less competitive in that direct way. Because,
right.
like, community fans probably spend less energy shitting on the Big Bang Theory than they do, like, comparing episodes of Community.
Right.
Where
right,
they're like, oh, I would have liked the Halloween episode more if it wasn't right after that other one with seven timelines. I'm like, who
And this is already, again, a small audience we're talking about.
Exactly.
Right? Like, it's a subset of a subset of a TV viewing audience. The best example I can think of where TV does cross that line into the dichotomy world is something that I always carried around in my brain, the way that you've been apparently carrying a torch for The Prestige over a movie that no one cares about. which for me, growing up, I was a big Star Wars guy. In fact, I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt right now featuring Princess Leia as Rosie the Riveter saying, "We can do it. Join the fight to defeat the Galactic Empire today." I have a lot of Star Wars stuff around. So, I'm a big Star Wars guy. I grew up loving Star Wars, but I also grew up thinking that meant I had to hate Star Trek. I don't know where that came from in my brain. Like, two of the bigger science fiction franchises of the 20th century, right?
Wow, yeah.
And, of course, Star Trek, we always forget, but it was a TV show, and, yep. and it's been a TV franchise primarily. It spun off big movies.
It's got some, yeah, some pretty
Yeah, it spun
hits.
Off big movies. It spun off books, right? Like, it spun off into a variety of media.
Yeah.
So has Star Wars. Star Wars has nonetheless, at its core, remained a film franchise and with, you know, TV tie-ins and other media,
like,
and Star Trek vice versa.
I remember you told me that once, and that was so baffling to me. Like, because I kind of get it in that they're both big space exploration franchises.
Right.
But they're just, in my mind, they're so differently oriented and differently placed. Like, Star Wars is the trilogy of movies, I think, was what we're talking about. The original three Star Wars. They're, like, straight-up space opera adventures, you know? And
right.
then Star Trek is something I always associated with, like, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, which are more, like, academic, very, very dry. They're like, let's pose a big question and have some, you know, have Patrick Stewart and a bunch of B actors pontificate about it for a while. That's what Star Trek's about.
And honestly, that's probably a big part of what, see, I also get that sense of it, right? And that's probably a big part of why I gravitated toward one and not the other.
Oh, sure.
Because as a kid, you're captivated by just the adventure aspect. And then as you get older, Han Solo is just a badass, right? Like, that has these anti-hero characters to relate to.
I think
you can start to relate to the dark side, right? Elements of that, right? The kind of punk rock. And then I watch Star Trek, and I'm like, wait, so this is basically like a big this is basically like the post office in space. And every so often they get attacked by another country's post office.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, and it bores the shit out of me. Like
Futurama.
But Futurama hilariously lampoons the best stuff of all of them.
But I think, well, and that's just more like, I think as a kid, I identified more with Data than Han Solo, let's be honest.
You are so, so
let's
sad.
Let's be honest, guys. We're all thinking it.
let's just play our cards on the table. Not a very badass little kid, all right? Yeah. And it's a Star Trek I really got into.
Well, I was more of a Luke than a Han, but we all want to be Han.
Sure, yeah, we all want to be Han. I definitely, and I love them both now.
I had options. I had to be Leia. Or an Ewok.
One because you're very pretty, and the other because you're 3 feet tall.
Ouch.
What?
Burn. He called me pretty. Dick.
Oh, man. Yeah, so I don't know. I never felt the need to make that choice, but I'm sure many people did.
Well, and that stuck out in my head. And again, and I realized, like, in having this conversation, we can use this to kind of segue away from TV, right?
Yeah, yeah.
One of the big reasons why that ostensibly TV franchise, Star Trek, stood out is probably because of the expanded universe of fiction that it created with movies and with books and with other media. Star Wars did the same thing.
Right.
And those other media have more of this false dichotomy idea to continue exploring.
Well, especially when something becomes a larger sort of franchise like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like when you have to immerse yourself in something, it can make it, and things seem similar enough, it's very like, oh, I'm going to choose one or the other, because who's
right.
got that kind
who,
of time?
Yeah, who has the time to consume both?
Right, exactly. And we were talking about one that involved comic books.
Yeah, so when it comes to the written word or publishing, books in general seem closer to TV in that nobody compares books. Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure if you're the kind of person who would get into the Chronicles of Narnia, you'd probably also enjoy the Lord of the Rings books.
Usually,
right?
yeah.
And I don't think people like really get so deeply entrenched in one that they think there's a natural enemy to them.
I wonder if back before there were other forms of entertainment, this happened. You know what I mean? Like, do you think we were joking about this earlier? But there must have been like poetry fans that are like Coleridge, no, Wordsworth, fuck you, and got
right.
Fist fights.
Right. Yeah, but you're into Ralph Waldo Emerson. I'm all about Henry David Thoreau.
Oh man,
I mean, they had a lot in common. They were, you know, probably lovers.
I challenge you to fisticuffs. But
meet me at Walden Pond.
It certainly doesn't happen with the printed word that much.
No. And comic books was the only place where it seems like there's been like a longstanding Coke or Pepsi, you know, choice to make.
And that would be DC or Marvel.
DC or Marvel. And I'm a bit of a comic book guy.
Yeah, me too.
But even in that particular question, as soon as we brought that idea up when we were kind of chatting about the ideas, the first question that I had was, well, do we count, you know, imprints of the, like, are we talking about mainstream
Vertigo.
Continuity? Because Vertigo is technically in the DC universe and owned by DC, and that's how I got into comic books. Like, I got into reading the more, you know, the more grown-up stories.
I'd consider that, like, akin to, like, I don't know, like late night programming or something. Like, right. Like when you're like NBC or Fox, you're not talking about,
right?
You know, you're not including like Conan versus Arsenio Hall or whatever. That was Fox was a bad choice for that. But Vertigo, I don't think
you pulled it out.
We're talking about the larger.
Those two shows didn't overlap, but you made a valiant
just
effort.
Just DC and Marvel, they've been around so long that all of their comics are commingled, and they have specific universes.
Right.
And as a kid, I felt I had to choose.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, absolutely.
The Marvel universe. Because it's awesome.
And talking about these mainstream universes, you're talking about the mainstream superhero continuity.
Yeah.
And I personally was a Marvel kid all the way.
Yeah.
And like most Marvel people, there is only one DC character that we can all unequivocally love because he's basically a Marvel character.
It's Batman.
Batman. Batman might as well just be a Marvel character.
Were you going to say somebody else, Sam?
No.
Okay.
No.
You look like you were ready.
Oh, look how ashamed she is. She totally had one.
You were ready to stump Wonder Woman or Aquaman or somebody lame
Aquaman.
Like that.
Aquaman. Yeah. You got me. I'm Aquaman's only fan.
But it wasn't so much like a conscious, I fought with other middle schoolers about it. Mm-hmm. It's just like I followed one even if I didn't read those specific books, so.
Yeah.
Now as all the movies come out and stuff, I realize I know way more about the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Than DC.
And I do have friends. I do have friends who prefer DC, but mostly I have friends who love DC and Marvel, and that's fine. You don't have to engage in this modern era in that false dichotomy thing. But really, that's kind of in some ways a postmodern way of looking at what Marvel versus DC was about.
Yeah.
It was only since the 80s and 90s and then into the 2000s that DC really rebranded its own image as being, okay, fine. Everyone talks about Marvel as being about real human beings who happen to have superpowers, right?
They're
human stories. They're grounded in realism, right?
They have real cities.
And DC embraces that it's big, overpowered, ridiculously powerful characters.
Yeah.
This is more about, it's a saga about the lives of gods. Living amongst mortals, and that's kind of a nice way of framing the old things that we used to complain about, which is you know, like Spider-Man has to fight Dr. Octopus in the middle of New York City, and hopefully no one gets hurt. Whereas you know, Superman has the power; he's indestructible and can destroy anything.
He's gonna fly to the sun. He'll just
chuck anything in the sun, and the threat's over.
I don't understand why he doesn't chuck everything into the sun.
Just everything. it's really hot. There.
It would be the most boring comic ever. He's just like, whoa, yeah, some sort of robot chucked it in the sun. Done.
And he lives in their sort of New York analog of Metropolis.
He lives in the clean New York, which is Metropolis, and Batman lives
in the dirty New York.
Batman lives in the shitty New York,
which is Gotham.
Which is Gotham, of course.
Yeah.
A lot of people think maybe Chicago. No, it's the shitty New York.
You know what I always thought was funny about DC?
What's that?
Right? Like Marvel, everything is set in Earth, right? Like,
yeah.
So everyone lives in New York City or whatever else, right? Like, and of course in DC, everyone lives in Star City or Metropolis, unless you're from the middle of America, which you're just from Kansas.
Well, this
right? They don't have New York, but they have Kansas.
Smallville is the only city that has like a state, like,
right?
Smallville, Kansas.
Yeah. Right.
That's not enough of a punchline.
And you know why it was? It was these pointy-headed East Coast comic book writers. They lived with and engaged in a New York City that they could create. A fictional version of, and then whenever someone's from the flyover states, you just go, oh, they're from fucking Kansas. Who cares?
So I wonder if it's still a thing that people think of as even those universes have become more splintered.
Yeah.
Like, Marvel has the ultimate versions of stuff that's more popular than the original titles. And
yeah, it was.
DC just rebooted everything as a sales gimmick kind
of. Cut themselves down to 52 titles.
I just mean, I think if you went to the Austin Wizard World Comic Con this weekend at the convention center and, like, asked all these creators, even they'd be like, I don't know, I never really thought about it. You know, like...
Yeah, right.
Like, I work for Vertigo, I work for Image, Wildstorm, yeah. And there's just too many more options now.
Yeah, and that influence has ultimately been good for comics, and I guess it's kind of helped us to at least define the terms of you know, yeah, the old DC Marvel conversation for this podcast.
But the number
but
one,
it doesn't prove that publishing, like, or that books and that realm of media lends itself to it.
That's not, well, I mean, if you want to get down into it, there's definitely, like, you know, Hemingway versus Fitzgerald, like, all sorts of things that are fueled by, you know, Franzen, Wallace, all of this stuff. These things that are fueled by, like, real life things. There's
literati,
I feel like,
nerds,
right? I feel like literature actually has a pretty intense.
but literati, but literati is the right word, and you're talking about
what you guys are talking about with your comic book universes, and who keeps up with this? Only a very certain subset of, like,
more people read Batman than the Corrections.
I hope so. Yeah,
I'm just saying. That's probably true, right?
But more people watch the HBO adaptation of The Corrections than watch Community, I'm sure. But I mean,
okay, and no, you said Community. This lit the literati.
But not then we'll watch The Dark Knight Rises.
Right. The literati debate thing. That is as small of a subset of the publishing world as the people who are super invested in hating The Big Bang Theory, because we all like Community is of the TV world.
Right.
Well, now, yeah, but back in, you know, the 20s and 30s, when people were debating over who their favorite, like, jazz age poet was, like, it wasn't well, as small
so
subset.
That's, and Duncan said that.
That's what, like, I was saying. Like, back before all these other things existed and books were less marginalized, I think there are really strong opinions.
Yeah, let's talk about other historical things that people have applied false dichotomies to.
Well,
there
is a different kind of medium that we want to get to that seems to lend itself to this false dichotomy as much as movies, even.
Here's the topic came up. The first thing that popped into my mind was Beatles or Rolling Stones.
Mm. And Beatles or Rolling Stones is that's the way I've always heard people frame it.
Right.
Until I saw Pulp Fiction and Quentin Tarantino has Uma Thurman ask John Travolta, there are two kinds of people. Beatles people, Elvis people. Really?
What a piece of nonsense.
Seriously? No. Like, the question is always Beatles or Stones, right?
Yeah.
Because, going back to that first criteria, naturally paired together two of the biggest bands to come from same time and place, the British Invasion, 60s music, right? And then they both went on divergent paths to being tremendously successful bands and tremendously creatively successful bands.
Exactly.
Who made great vital works and continue to be relevant even today just for the quality of their music.
One of them is slightly more vital.
Right. So Stones or Beatles? Duncan, Stones or Beatles?
Beatles all the way.
Rolling Stones.
Oh.
Stones for sure.
Ouch.
Here's the thing. I didn't grow up listening to the Beatles all the time, and so I just went through my, like, going through and really listening to them all. Because you always think, like, oh, I've heard all their songs, because they're always on the radio. But the Beatles really are one of those bands where you can hear every one of their number one hits or get that number one compilation, and they're all great songs, and they're all big hits. And then you listen to the White Album for the first time and go, wow, this is a good band.
I thought you were going to rip on the White Album and I was about to get ripped.
No. I'm saying, like, I've just gone through, like, my like, real appreciation,
like,
for the
Stones.
The
Stones have never unpacked for me that way, where I just listen to their albums and find more than I expected.
Part of that is because they're not... I mean, the Beatles are the original album-oriented band. People often credit them with being the first ones to think of the LP format as an artistic form, right? Yeah. Like, and create all their content for that record
and plus,
in a,
like,
unified vision.
And just, I get so nerded out about the Beatles, I even have a choice in the Lennon-McCartney debate, which is...
I do too.
Where you fall.
Well, okay, let's do this tangent.
I can pretty much predict...
My favorite Beatle
is
Paul McCartney.
Oh, mine too.
George Harrison.
See, George Harrison. Oh, God. The same,
I don't really like
obvious
Beatles
hipster
much.
Pick. Every time.
You don't like what? You don't like Lennon that much?
No,
like the Beatles.
I don't really like... I mean, I understand everything. I enjoy the Beatles. I don't dislike them or anything. But just... I think partly the circumstances I grew up in, which were the people who liked the Beatles when I was growing up, were also the people who ended up being really into fish in high school. And I always kind of like, I kind of sort of lumped a lot of things together. And yeah, this is going to make me sound terrible, so whatever. But I will say the Stones are more like in line with my taste and my lifestyle and my like everything than the Beatles. I see the Beatles as a little more like, in my mind, they're always the like clean cut, nerdy early Beatles.
What? Types. Okay. I get it. I'm more of a Sgt. Pepper, you know, White Album.
Yeah, I like all that too, but the Stones have...
Like, that's what I'm talking
about. Okay, so we talked about we got slightly down the rabbit hole talking about albums, right? Yeah, uh-huh. And you like that because the Rolling Stones, you said you don't unpack an album the way you do with the Beatles.
Yeah.
The Rolling Stones modeled themselves off after a much longer tradition of single song oriented music,
right?
Like processing all of like blues and roots music and Americana,
yeah,
by artists who would often only get to cut a song or two at a time. Artists who you would hear in concert as a complete experience, and the Rolling Stones, nobody's ever argued the Rolling Stones were hands down a better concert band, one of the greatest live bands who ever walked the planet, right? Like you see, like when you watch Gimme Shelter and you see the Rolling Stones playing in 1972, yeah, you get that band instinctively.
Oh, and I love the Stones. That's the hidden part.
It's on the albums, too.
Yeah.
See, for me, a big turning point for me was finally, like, sitting down with Exile on Main Street. And after listening to it and, like really processing it and engaging with it, it shot up there on my list of, like, albums that I can't live without. And it's almost a cliche to say it because it's true. It is the best Rolling Stones album, despite not having any of their biggest hits on it. It's the only album that really plays and feels like an album. In part because they took the best chunks of songs they'd been working on and then were forced to work on them all at the same time when in France together, as opposed to just kind of piecemealing songs as they wrote them and putting singles together as they wrote them and releasing them as singles as they did.
Right.
And then they had like four of those, and then they'll fill it out with a couple of jams they make in the studio, which is what kind of defined a lot of their other records, right? But a band's record and discography alone does not make the band. It doesn't define the music.
No, and it's been so much different to follow, especially these two bands that way, because the Beatles are such like a story you can follow in music almost, because
right,
they go through these very clear stages, and they have, you know, such...
Beatles Rock Band taught me that very well.
There you go.
Yeah. It's so much fun.
Yeah, I had a drum set in high school. I played along to the White Album and stuff. It's just...
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, but when you give me a choice between like who has more specific songs that I like, I guess maybe the Beatles do. But in terms of like wanting to actually sit down and listen to a band for the length of an album or more,
yeah,
it's actually not the Beatles. It's definitely the Rolling Stones.
Right.
They're also just way more rock, there's more of a rock band, you know.
Right.
Which again, I guess I'm always drawn to the anti-hero, the danger, that part of rock. And as much as the Beatles are not just the mop top kids, even if they're most dangerous, their most dangerous was taking LSD and hanging out with Ravi Shankar. Like their most dangerous was wearing Nehru jackets in India.
Okay, sure. I've never been to India. What do you want from me?
Well, your favorite Beatle. I just want to get to the favorite Beatle thing really fast.
Yeah.
George Harrison has the best Beatles solo album of any of them.
Oh, that's a great album.
No question.
Yeah, yeah.
All Things Must Pass is the best Beatles solo album.
Well, thanks.
But Paul McCartney is my go-to. Paul McCartney is the guy who, he had the greatest breadth of songs that he wrote for the Beatles. People don't realize, like, he wasn't just the pop one. He wrote Yesterday.
Yep.
And he also wrote what people often point to as, like, the first or, like, one of the most important, like, antecedents to heavy metal. He wrote Helter Skelter. Like, that is some serious, like, swing and talent there, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
He had a lot more
He wrote a Helter Skelter and Silly Love Songs? That's amazing.
That's amazing,
yeah,
right? Yeah. That guy I'm totally down with.
So the Beatles and Stones is the only, like, big historical one that really...
It's the one that jumped out.
The one that I can choose. Otherwise, there's, like, in my lifetime have been, like, certain waves in music, like boy bands, for example.
Boy bands.
Where,
which we wrote down to talk about before Sam brought up.
Even if it wasn't my bread and butter, I didn't have MTV, like, in middle school, like, 95 through 98, so all that popular stuff, whatever it was. But I did get it around the turn of the century. All right? So, like Britney Spears, NSYNC, New Kids on the Block, that was all playing all the time. And I remember thinking to myself, well, at least NSYNC doesn't take themselves so seriously.
That was a big one. Well, when NSYNC and Backstreet Boys were out, the 98 Degrees and O-Town, and it was like, it wasn't just like this versus that. It was like...
All pretenders to the throne. Well, Backstreet and NSYNC were...
They were the two.
Of course, but it's
way beyond
often had its faction. So I think that's an example of one that like started as a very real dichotomy for everyone and then became like an actual huge thing.
Yeah. Well, it's telling that Duncan telling in this topic that Duncan started watching and his first like real experience with MTV was at the era where that the biggest show on one of the biggest cable networks in the world was Total Request Live.
Total Request
Live. A show that was based on the idea of making teenage girls call or to pick to vote one over the other, placing every single day the latest NSYNC video versus the latest Backstreet Boys video to see which would be one and which would be two. Like, literally putting them in direct competition with one another.
That's all. And they had those little bumpers they filmed, the live studio people, they'd get them to, like, woo about...
My name is Tina, I'm from Holland, New Jersey, and I love the Backstreet Boys to the heart of it!
Okay. Anyway.
That was already, like, long after I was of an age to be interested in it. But...
Yeah.
It was really interesting to watch at that point. Like, being old enough to be, like, kind of into punk rock and, like, what is going on with this? And watching people, like, flip out over it.
Yeah, even if, like, I only cared for one song on TRL that day, I would still be like, Nookie, number one, again, guys, seriously. And it's just an arbitrary vote. Like, I understood it was what was popular and who still paid attention to TRL, which...
Well, and then they did all that stuff where, like, people would start campaigns online to get, like, some 80s... pre-Rick Rolling, like trying to vote some.
Oh, yeah.
Never got traction.
Sometimes it did. Sometimes they got up to like 5 or 6, and people would be like, yeah, we made a difference, you guys.
We changed the landscape.
Just dusting their hands off together and heading back inside.
Cheeto dust falling on their keyboard.
We turned some heads today. Yeah. We did it. TRL's never going to be.
Culture War won.
Yeah, but that's, we feel like these artists are at war with one another.
Well, but that was also very intentional, because when you look at something like, New Kids on the Block or Backstreet Boys are NSYNC, you got the bad boy, you got the sweetheart, like they are pitting them against each other.
Within the bands themselves even, there was the competition for who got on more posters, right? Like, and which one you said was your favorite or the one you said you had a crush on said as much about you as a person as Beatles or Elvis or Beatles almost.
That's a whole complex formula.
You like Howie D? Really? Who likes Howie D the best? I like the nameless one.
I like the nameless one. I like the one in that hat that's always askew. I don't know.
I like Joey Fatone because I saw him in the starring role in Rent one time.
Joey Fatone.
Right.
I
like the one who's clearly 10 years older than the others.
Yeah, right? I like the one whose last name is Fat One.
My favorite boy band, by the way. My favorite boy band, by the way, was the MTV parody band. Together, the number two.
Yeah, the one who died. I had a huge crush on him.
What was the name of the fake boy band in Josie and the Pussycats?
I never saw it.
It had
the one with Seth Green and Breckin Meyer
and like Donald Faison. It was great.
Oh my god!
I know, right?
That is an all-star lineup of 90s to 2000s.
Sam's gonna get the name of that.
90s to 2000s teen movie people.
So much.
Great
and
movie.
I think, like, every day that I want to go back and rewatch it, so...
Great movie with songs written by Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne.
Fountains of Wayne.
I just felt the need to mention that.
Fountains of Wayne, not a great band. I'm sorry.
Oh, they're the best.
My favorite Fountains of Wayne song is Sink to the Bottom, which I think was, like, their first Buzzbin single.
First album. I would imagine their first single was Radiation Vibe.
Du jour.
Sink to... Du jour.
Du jour.
Du jour.
The boy band from Josie and the Pussycats.
Du jour.
Oh, but what was their song?
What are we doing with our lives, you guys?
Winning?
I'm doing well.
Yeah.
I
wanted to mention that MTV, like, sort of based a lot of its culture on pitting things against each other on TRL.
Right.
And later, I think, or maybe around that time, they made that overt with Celebrity Deathmatch. Remember that? Which literally had, like...
Yeah.
Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera fighting to the death, which is, I guess, what we always wanted to see.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is that if you want people to spend money on something, you got to get them super irrationally invested in it for whatever reason. So these kinds of things are obviously genius and serve their purpose in the way that they should.
Well, and looking at Celebrity Deathmatch, you always saw that they would put people pit entities against each other, but it was rarely... TV person versus TV person, or book person versus book person. Like it seems to bear out.
There's movie stars.
It seemed to bear out that kind of thing. And like with TRL, You have an example of a TV show that was basically just facilitating the music debate that people wanted to have, like the music industry, you know, and the way the music industry kind of pushes its products in that way that feeds the false dichotomy thing to fuel record sales.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how all culture works ultimately. You got to get somebody so attached that they're willing to fight about it.
Yeah, and as we're having this conversation, like, the reasons that we're giving for why we have these opinions are obviously deeply personal and don't apply to anything beyond this, our own sphere of whatever. And
No, mine are all right.
Well, okay.
Mine are correct, factually. They're in this book right here. I wrote them down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we're talking about them and what, like, obviously, I think of everything from, like, a really weird business sense. But, like, what better way for people to figure out, like, what people want than to get them talking about
right. That
kind of thing?
Yeah. Let's see what people are willing to argue about. And, yeah, that's – we're not calling this episode completely true dichotomies that are relevant today. But, yeah, it's obviously, like, I didn't think I had such strong opinions about Back to the Future over Bill and Ted.
Until someone made you confront
– But apparently I have, and they've lingered into, quote-unquote, adulthood. So
I'm glad we were able to hash them out today.
Think about your own. I don't know. Maybe tell us about them.
Yeah. You can tell us about them either on this post on Culture Map.
Tell Brendan how wrong he is about everything and just, you know.
Tell Duncan how bland he is. And
if you identified with Data as a child, we should start a group about it. Because, you know, there's a lot of...
Yeah, you should start a group on the internet.
Oh, my God.
Because that's what kids like you do, isn't it?
That's what we do. That's cool. But just write us, let us know. You can follow the Pop Almanac at Pop Almanac on Twitter.
I am at BK O'Grady.
I'm at A. Duncan Carson.
We also have a Facebook page. You can like us on Facebook at the Pop Almanac.
Yeah, just search that, Culture Map, at Culture Map ATX. And we should probably finally mention that you can follow Sam Pitchell. It's Sam, it's the word Samantha with an S at the front and an A at the end.
Yeah, that's me.
That's it. Until next time, you guys.
Have a great week. Make some hard choices. What's on your mind when you're tired at the end of the day? Where do you